Well, I put a different disc in and we'll see how it works and if we can make this thing work, but we're...
I pushed that disc kind of hard, and that's when it seemed to come on for me.
Okay. Well, usually, you know, I'll tell the disc, in these recording units, and I'll just say, I love you, I love you, I love you. And I figure that'll turn it on. Boo. Okay. pretty lame. And this is recording, by the way. God bless everybody out there, all three of you that listen on the internet. When I was a child and something bad happened around the house, I was amazed that the first person that everyone assumed was guilty was me. Not my sisters. Of course, they had sweet smile and they were, after all, girls. And they couldn't be guilty, and not the neighbors, not anyone else. It wasn't an accident. It was me. So I learned all sorts of excuses that I could give when I was blamed for something. I would never admit my culpability or my guilt, and I'd never use the sin word for sure, because after all, I grew up in Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average, and so that, you know, the way I looked at myself. But if there was an odd smell wafting through the living room, I always said, it's the dog. Or if there were cookies missing, I'd say, well, obviously someone was sleepwalking and got hungry and they must have eaten them. If the chores weren't done, I would say I'm not old enough or I don't get enough allowance or child labor laws. I brought up all sorts of excuses like that. And if my math wasn't finished or I missed school, I would always say, well, I was sick. And I was sick of school. Yeah, and so you get the idea there of what it was all about. But the one I enjoyed the most was something I was hearing all the time in the news. It was called temporary insanity. It's just temporary insanity. I don't know what came over me. I wasn't in my right mind. And then I found out now by checking on the internet that 1 in 4 people are not sane. Did you realize that? 1 out of every 4 people in America have some sort of mental illness and they're not sane. So just look down the row, and if the next 3 people look pretty normal, it's you. Okay, you're the problem. Well, Israel was just a few weeks out of slavery. They had learned to grumble, they learned to gripe, they learned to blame, they learned to question God, and it was more than temporary insanity. It was more than momentarily being out of sorts or being fussy by nature. Unfortunately for Israel and for us still today, it was stubbornness, a persistent problem of not believing God. Not something rare or infrequent, but over and over and over again. We are in Exodus chapter 17, verses 1 to 7 in today's message. And it gives us a progression in how the Jews, now just a few weeks into their Exodus, are doing the same thing over and over and over again. Questioning God. Testing God, saying, I don't believe what you said. The problem that underlies today's account in Exodus 17 is a universal problem. We need to explore it as a problem and then see what causes it and how to deal with it. And so we divided the message into 2 parts. The first part will deal with these 7 verses, and the second part with a number of other texts that will help us get a different perspective on it. So let's first of all try to understand this story. It starts out with grumbling. All the congregation of the people of Israel were in Exodus 17, verse 1, moved on from the wilderness of Zin by stages, according to the commandment of Yahweh, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. The stages that God led them are not included here, but if you turn over to Numbers chapter 33, matter of fact, all of Numbers 33 deal with a detailed thing that we went here first, then here, then next, then Sinai, and then all these other places, most of which we don't read anywhere else in the Bible because not much happened there. But God's recording the journey through the wilderness areas. In Numbers 33, they set out from before Hotroth, passed through the midst of the sea. Remember, they went there to the other side. They went 3 days' journey into the wilderness of Etham and camped at Marah. What happened at Marah? Y'all remember? Marah was the bitter water. Okay. Call me not Marah, Naomi tells Ruth. They set out from Marah and came to Elim. At Elim were 12 springs and 70 palm groves. I mean, a beautiful area there, and they camped there. Then they set out from Elim, went along the Red Sea. They're going down the Sinai Peninsula. They set out from the Red Sea and camped in the wilderness of Zin. And then they set out from the wilderness of Zin and camped at Dophkah. And after they left Dophkah, they camped at Alush. I don't know anything about these places, but they're real. They set out from Alush and camped at Rephidim, where there was no water for the people to drink. And so the Jews are, we record here the stages that they would journey. They would stay for 3 or 4 days, perhaps a week. Then they would journey another 30 or 40 miles, and then they'd stay there for perhaps a month. God was in no hurry to bring his people out of the wilderness and into the land of Canaan. God knew it was going to be a long journey, a year and a half. He was going to take them to Sinai, give them the law, help them to understand the law, become a spiritual people, and then go up to Canaan. And we all know that after a year and a half, they rebelled, they didn't obey God, and God condemned them to wander for 38 and a half more years in the wilderness. Again, going to a place, camping for a month, a year or more in the same place and moving on, but never going to Canaan during that 38 and a half years, allowing every one of the unbelieving adults to die. Everyone, except for Joshua and Caleb, the only two that were allowed in. Israel's wandering is not what we're talking about. We're talking about their boot camp, their training to remain faithful to God. So Israel did exactly what God commanded. They followed the pillar of cloud and fire, and yet there was no water to drink. It's important for us to realize that sometimes the will of God is going to lead us into some really difficult places. He hasn't promised us a Disneyland. He hasn't promised us that everything is going to be great. A couple of weeks ago when I preached, I said that we're about the trail. I said I was going to be heading out in the morning for California. And God gave us a wonderful time. There are no problems on the freeways as long as my wife kept her eyes shut. And she was driving. And a wonderful time. And, you know, I said, Lord, thank you. This was really nice. I'm glad to be home. Glad when I got home, it only took 2 more days to get the gas finally working again, have hot water. But we think that's the way it should be every day. But you know, and I know, that's not the way it is. Things happen. We get sick. We have injuries. We have financial troubles. We have in-law troubles or outlaw troubles or car troubles or house troubles, or we have, you know, trauma that happens when, let's just for example, when our oldest son would leave home for the first time, the heartbreak and the trauma of a child leaving home. I don't want to mention Caleb by name, but we already mentioned Caleb earlier, but not the same one. Well, it was God who led Israel into the trouble, into the trial, into the test. Israel went from place to place as the Lord commanded, and if they found themselves in a place where there was no water, it was God's problem, not theirs, because God led them. And so the people recognized that. They were a spiritual people. And they said, oh, this is not our problem, it's God's problem. We'll pray and let him take care of it. No, that's not exactly what they said in verse 2. Therefore, the people griped with Moses, demanding, give us water to drink. They didn't ask him. They demanded water to drink. Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle? Now, Israel had a real problem. They only had so much water. They just traveled down to this area. They'd used the water that they'd taken with them. They needed water. It wasn't imaginary. They had the right to be concerned. But the matter was a spiritual issue. God led them, and God said, I'll take care of you. It wasn't the problem with Moses, but he was the one that was close enough there. He was the one with skin and bones on. They couldn't yell at God, so they yelled at the preacher. They should have said, hey, we're in the desert. We're not surprised that there's no water here. Duh. That's why it's called the desert. And they needed to look to God. But they viewed their problem as a disaster. It indicated to them that God had abandoned them. And they questioned whether God was with them or not. They didn't see his presence, his provision, his protection. They didn't understand or remember that just earlier, what had God done? He'd led them from Egypt. They'd survived 10 plagues. Then he led them from Egypt. He split the Red Sea for them to walk across. He destroyed the enemy's army so it couldn't chase them. He'd given them food, right? Manna, quail. He'd given them water when it was the time. And what do? They bring up the same old, lame old excuse. Well, Lord, you're not taking care of us. We're all going to die. Life isn't good and life isn't fair. They remind me of snowflakes. You know what I'm talking about? Snowflakes that just, they glisten and then they melt and they're gone. And no matter what happens, it's a term used of some of the millennials today that are whining and unable to handle the trials of life. But these people said, okay, we're going to die. Worse than that, our kids are going to die. And because these were Wyoming ranch type Israelis, our cows are going to die. We're going to lose the sheep and the cattle that we have. So, verse 4, the question. Moses cried to Yahweh, what shall I do with these people? They're about ready to stone me. It had escalated from grumbling, from asking him for help, from griping, to quarreling, now to threatening his life. They're picking up stones. They're going to kill him. This is a escalation of the violence, it's just demonstrating the lack of faith that they had. Unlike you and me. When God does something for us, we praise him, we come to church, we share a testimony, God is so good, and then something bad happens, something happens that we don't want, and what do?
Despair.
Yeah, we whine, we grumble, we gripe, we threaten, we hold our breath until we turn blue. One of Moses' great characteristics is when he was faced with the trouble, he did the right thing. He said, they're ready to kill me, Lord, but he was talking to God. See, he was dealing with the problem the way it should be. The people were unfair to him. He was the leader. It wasn't his fault. He was doing what God wanted him to do. But one of his praiseworthy traits is that Moses took his problems to the Lord. He figured, okay, God, you're in control. The people wanted to test God. Are you really here, God? We're going to give you a test. You better give us water, X, Y, Z, or we're not going to believe in you anymore. How foolish is that? And so from the grumbling, it passes to grace. In verse 5, Yahweh said to Moses, this is what to do. Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Don't retreat, don't whine, don't fall into the same problem the Jews are that you're leading. You're in charge. Go out in front of them. Take the rod. They'll know what that is. They know what that rod is. That's what split the Nile and or they turned it into blood. And, oh, man, you take that and show your leadership. Take the other leaders of Israel with you. And remember that I'm in charge, that it's my power, that I am with you. Even when you can't see me, even when you're thirsty, I am with you. Even when your prayers aren't answered, I am with you. Even when circumstances don't work the way you think they should work, I am with you. There's a theme that God's getting across here, that he was with the people. He was there. They just had to believe. He gives this wonderful promise in verse 6. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb. And you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did this in plain sight of the elders. What a remarkable promise. He's going to go to a rock. Now, over in the desert by Rephidim today, there is a rock. It's pictured in the bulletin for you. It's a giant rock that stands right up out, just by all by itself, and it is split right down the middle. And, of course, they wanted to build a Catholic church on it, but they wouldn't allow that. And the people there said, oh, this must be the holy site. That's the only rock in the area like this. And it's split. God must have done that. Folks, I don't know if that's the rock or not. And you know what? I don't care if that's the rock or not. I'm just saying that that's what they have there, that God was there standing by the rock, and that all Moses had to do was hit the rock with the staff of God. It would split in two, and water would gush out to feed a million people and all their animals. I mean, we're talking about a river of water flowing out. Now, scientists, don't we always love what scientists have to say about crossing the Red Sea, all these miracles? Scientists said, this is a natural phenomenon. There was an artesian well just under the surface. And when Moses tapped it, it was all it took. And the well burst forth. And Moses could find this vein of water that was near the surface. And just the right place, he uncapped its supply. Now, how many of you ever watched the Beverly Hillbillies? Did any of you watch that? Okay. How did Jed Clampett get so wealthy? He was shooting and he missed what he was shooting at and hit the ground and, whoa, there was a vein of oil that just sprouted up and flowed. All. I don't, okay.
Texas tea.
Crude. Black, okay, yeah, you all watch the show too often. You're giving me the whole, tell me a story about a man named Jed. Okay, we're all going to start singing in a minute here. Oh, thank you, Jesus. Good illustration, Griffin. But, you know, isn't that it? Just happened to be the right spot, and up comes, well, that's Moses. You know, he just went over there and went, oh, yeah, this is the right spot, and tapped it there, and as a geologist, he, well, yeah, give me a break. But when they had all the water that they needed for themselves and for their flocks and their children, Moses said, I'm going to rename this place. I know it's called Rephidim. That's the name of the city here. But he called the name of the place two Hebrew words, Massa and Meribah. Massa means test. Meribah means quarrel. They tested. They were tested, and all they did was fight. They tested God. Wrong move. He named it Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, because they tested Yahweh by saying, is the Lord among us or not? We're told over and over again, you're not supposed to test the Lord. You're not supposed to tempt the Lord. You're not supposed to doubt the Lord. Deuteronomy 6:16, you shall not tempt the Lord your God, like they tempted him in Massah. He's telling the next generation in Deuteronomy 6, almost 40 years later. In Deuteronomy 9, at Massah, you provoked the Lord to wrath. Deuteronomy 33:8, your Holy One, whom you tested at Massah and who you contended with at the waters of Meribah. Over and over, Moses is given this message. God showed he was there, he was going to take care of him, and they doubted his presence. G. Campbell Morgan, the great preacher, said, under the stress of an immediate lack, the people doubted the one fact that of which they had overwhelming evidence. What fact was that? That God was there. He was going to take care of them. The psalmist said in Psalm 95, and we're going to read it together, in Psalm 95, he tells us about this story and a reminder to the next generation. As the psalmist read, now we're going to read this out loud, so you got to get your Bibles or your hymn books already there. Psalm 95, number 708. As we read this together and are reminded, now we read earlier in the service in our time of singing and praise a psalm a few psalms later, Psalm 103, of God's provision. But this one comes not just with his provision, but with a warning about Massah and Meribah, about how they need to listen and be reminded. So let's read together Psalm 95. Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. Today, if only, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did at day at Massah in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested and tried me, though they had seen what I did. For 40 years
I was angry with that generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared an oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest.
And so the psalmist uses this illustration as he sings to the rock. Think about that. They just did not understand. Okay, that's the story. And the sermon continues, though, with the application of this, the lessons here. Because the first one is the epitaph of the hardness of man's heart. How man will fail the test. How man falls so short of what God desires. Now, we have a number of scriptures. I'll read them, but they're listed out in your notes for you so that we can study them at your leisure. But notice them failing God's test, because God designed this. God led them. And remember, God had already tested them at Marah a few weeks earlier. And they whined and complained, and God took care of it. Now, they passed the test at Marah then and said, okay, we've learned the lesson. And what does a good teacher do when a student says, I know the answer now, I've learned the lesson? You test them again. You make sure. You throw a little wrinkle in, maybe a little twist. And so they're thirsty, they're hungry. They've come down to another place, and Moses said, the pillar stopped, this is where we're gonna camp. And they look around, there's a little village there that probably had a well in it for enough to feed a few people or keep a few people thirsty. Other than that, there was no water anywhere in the area, not for, you know, all of the Jews. But God said, I'm testing you. How did they do? Psalm 81, verse 7, he said, I tested you at the waters of Meribah. Psalm 106, 14 and 15, you lusted exceedingly in the wilderness, testing God in the desert. And God gave you a request, but sent leanness to your soul. Deuteronomy 8, 16, that he might humble you and test you, to do good as a result. Oh, that's what teachers do, right? I don't know about you. I homeschooled my kids. I thought it was a great time. They thought it was okay. But for some reason, they don't want to homeschool their kids, they said. However, I found out now that two in California will be homeschooled this next year, as well as seven others will be homeschooled. Six, excuse me. I've got one in college now. In Illinois are going to be homeschooled. So maybe it wasn't all that bad. But I used to do this all the time. I quiz them and test them and make sure they understood. And then give them more information and test them. And when I tested them, I'd review the test questions from before. Till finally, by the end of the semester, you know, man, my test was pages and pages and pages long because I wanted them to make sure they knew it all. That they didn't just wander through and sit in the classroom and stare at the clock until it turned 3:15, and he who endures till the end shall be passed on to the next grade. I wanted to make sure they really learned. And my children don't hate me for it. So parents, be thankful. You know, you hang in there with your work there. It was good. Testing reveals what a person knows. And in this case, it revealed that the Jews didn't know. They didn't have faith. They had mental knowledge. Yeah, our God is great. He can do everything. But here I am dying of thirst. I can't trust him. Their willfulness, their waywardness, their lack of faith surfaced. And God had to demonstrate his grace again, showing it was by grace, not by their works. They didn't go out and dig wells. They didn't go out and find water on their own. God said, Moses, hit the rock. No created being has the right to test God. We can't dictate to God our terms. Let's just understand this lesson real simply. We can't say, Lord, if you're really God, you have to do false. Stop right there. We don't tell God what he has to do. Matter of fact, isn't it the other way around? That God tells us what we have to do? God proven himself with all these miracles in the previous months. How arrogant, how inappropriate, how sinful for the Jews to try and make the creator of the universe jump through their hoops. And it all was because of their lack of faith. Again, in Psalm 106, verses 24 and 25, they simply did not believe his promise. They grumbled in their tents, and they didn't obey the Lord. Psalm 78, 57, like their fathers, they were disloyal and faithless, as unreliable as a bow with a faulty string. Satan challenged Jesus the same way when he was in the wilderness. Now, he was in the wilderness of Judea, not in the Sinai. But you remember that? After Jesus presented himself as the Messiah, the Lamb of God, he was baptized, and the Spirit led him off into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. And Satan there came out in the wilderness. Let me read it to you, Matthew 4, verses 5 through 7. Then the devil took him to the holy city, set him on the highest pinnacle of the temple, and said, If you're the Son of God, prove it. Jump. And it's commanded, He'll have his angels concerning you. Their hands will bear you up lest you strike your foot against the stone. And Jesus said, it's written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And by the way, where did Jesus quote from? Deuteronomy, in the same passage where Moses is telling the Jews, don't test God like you did at Massa and Meribah. Don't do it. Satan's doing the same thing. Prove it. Satan had no right to challenge God, suggesting that God was unreliable, that he couldn't be trusted for his promises, that Jesus would have to do some miraculous sign in front of thousands of people. We don't trust God when we demand proof. Trust is simply trust. If we demand proof, that shows that we don't trust God. It's sort of like, well, let me use a modern illustration. Y'all following what's happening in North Korea right now? The North Korean government are developing missiles and weapons to be able to launch, and right now with their newest missile, they can hit the west coast of the United States. They can hit all the way to New York City. Their newest weapons can't quite make Washington, D.C., sadly. And they are, you say, well, what in the world is going to happen? They don't want us to come in to North Korea and examine their nuclear reactors, that they're not making bombs. America's position is trust, but verify. President Reagan said that many times, you know, about the Russians in his day, that when people make a treaty and they say, well, we're going to do this, we say, fine. We believe you, but we want to make sure. You see, when you're going to check and when you're going to try to make sure that they don't do what you, that's showing we don't really believe you. We're really afraid you're going to try and send a bomb over and blow up whatever. We don't trust them. And you can substitute in the Russians or the Iranians, or who else are we in battle with today? Half the world you can put into there. You know, trust, but verify, because we really don't trust them. The illustration of trusting God, period. Saying, Lord, you're in charge. We have faith. That's found with three Hebrew young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You all familiar with them? The fiery furnace? That the sound of the trumpets was, everybody's supposed to kneel down to the image of the king and worship it? And what happened? Daniel 3:17, they said, if we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God who we serve is able to save us. But if he doesn't rescue us, we want you to know, King, we're not going to serve your gods or worship your image. We're going to trust God. That's the kind of faith that God wanted from the Jews. Sadly, this is almost 1,000 years later, the story of these men. Faith, trust in God, even when the results appear to be fatal. Let me repeat that. Faith, trust in God, even when the results appear to be fatal. The Israelis should have learned by now that God's going to give his promise and he's going to take care of them. There's no problem. He says, I'm going to lead you, I'm going to give you my law, I'm going to take you to the promised land. And that should have been end of discussion. Sadly, the psalmist said in Psalm 106, verse 14, they soon forgot what he had done. They didn't wait for his counsel. In the desert, they gave in to their cravings. In the wasteland, they tested God. Have a need? Wait on the Lord. Trust what he said. God's going to take care of it. We don't live that way today. We live in instant gratification. I have instant coffee. instant tea. I have instant soup. I don't even have to let water boil. I have a microwave. I can have anything I want in a minute, right now. Gimme, 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 Lord. I've got it all. But maturity doesn't come instantly. Growing in Christ in our life is not something that just happened. You say, I got saved, and oh, here I am. I'm a mature Christian. It takes time. We have to grow. We have to learn. We have to study His Word. We need to sometimes fall so that He can pick us up and we can be reminded again and again and again of His care for us. Israel doubted God's presence. Incredible to me. But days have come in my life where I doubt His presence. I doubt that He's there all the time. I doubt that He's that concerned with me. These are nagging doubts that I just share with you folks because it's real. God said, trust. Follow My word. That's all that He asks. And what will He do? Well, the epitaph, yeah, that whole generation, their kids spent their whole time writing epitaphs on the tombstones of their parents because every one of their parents died. But to the new generation that was growing up, they were learning the evidence of grace. That the rock was there. The rock was a symbol of God's faithfulness. Psalm 105, 41 and 42 says, He opened the rock, water gushed out like a river in the desert. For God remembered His holy promise. That's the kind of God we need to remember. When we get down, when we get discouraged, when we think, well, boy, this is really tough. God's promises. Deuteronomy 32, verse 3 and 4 says, I'll proclaim the name of the Lord. Oh, praise the greatness of our God. He is the rock. His works are perfect. His ways are just. In Psalm 81 talks about another aspect of the rock. You can tell I did a little study on the rock. Not because I'm interested in pro wrestling. It's because this is an analogy. Every Jew, I mean, the rock is a name for Jesus. It's a name for Jehovah, for God. That He'll give them honey from the rock. I like that. Maybe the water that came out there was sweet. I don't know how it all goes. But remarkable, against the laws of nature, we see the rock providing for the people, giving hope for the people. It says in Isaiah 48:21, they did not thirst when He led them through the desert, for He made water to flow from the rock. He split the rock and water gushed out. I find that this story that we're looking at today of God providing water from the rock is mentioned more than almost every other story throughout all the pages of the Old Testament and the New. It's to remind us of the provision and to give us hope for the future, that God was there providing sustenance. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul sucks this illustration from the Old Testament and said, they ate the same spiritual food that we eat. They drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and the rock was Christ. For the rock was a symbol of God's power. It was a symbol of His presence. The Jews didn't know that every rock in the wilderness could be tapped with a staff and water would gush out if God said so, if God planned it. The Jewish legend is quite humorous to me because I learned this story when I was a young child. And the Jews said that Moses struck the rock and it gave water. And then, bum, 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 the rock followed them all the rest of the years in the wilderness. And no matter where they camped, there was water flowing. Okay, I thought this was cool. They got a pillar of cloud and fire leading them. And then to make sure there's nobody straggling, they got a rock rolling after them. It just brings to mind Roadrunner cartoons for some reason. That just, you know, you just see these Jews just running down there, and then whenever they stop, the water comes. Well, I don't read that in there, but that was their legend. But it's a metaphor. Paul, you know, three times uses the word spiritual. He said it was spiritual food, spiritual water, spiritual rock. It wasn't that Jesus was actually there, I'm a rock, and that's, you know, what it is. But the same thing, the irony here is that the Jews doubted God's presence, and God was right there with them. Is God here or not? And there's the pillar of cloud and fire. There's the rock gushing water. And they're saying, is God here or not? Look up irony in the dictionary and you'll see a split rock, perhaps. God had said and promised them and that he would stand before them on the rock. Not as the rock, it's a metaphor here that he's talking about, that he is on the rock. That God is there, that he is present with them, that he is saving them. As Moses struck the rock, and the life-giving water flowed, what sort of picture does that bring in your mind? But of Jesus, the rock, being stricken by man on the cross. And Toplady wrote, let the water and the blood from thy riven side which flowed be of sin the double cure. Save me from its wrath and power. What's the name of that song? Rock of Ages. Oh, amazing. When times are rough, God is with us, saving us, abiding with us. Somebody said that they wanted a church that's spirit-filled, that's all sorts of activity, that because the Jews of old evidenced that God was blessing if a person was wealthy, if they had a good family, if they were successful, if they were popular, if they didn't have any troubles, they said, oh, that must be a good man. We do that today sometimes. Maybe not consciously, but we look at them and say, yeah, they have a pretty good life. Look at all the money they have. Look at all, everything is so good. And we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And we see churches that are saying, oh, you know, look at this, you know, we've got, we're meeting here in a church building with, you know, 25,000 people. And we're preaching in front of the TV cameras, and God must be really with that ministry. What is he doing in Casper, Wyoming? To a handful of people in a hotel meeting room. God must not be with them. But when we think that God isn't with us, we're missing the point. He came into this world to be God with us. Isn't that what Matthew 1:23 said? The virgin will be with child, bring forth the son, they'll call his name Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. God's right here. He was present at Massa in Meribah. He was sovereign over them, leading them, traveling from place to place, teaching them in adversity, in struggle, in difficult times. He was teaching them hard lessons that they needed to learn, folks. Deuteronomy 8 says, he led you through the vast and dreadful desert, the thirsty and waterless land with its venomous snakes and scorpions. He even brought you water out of solid rock. Another reference to this story. The psalmist said in Psalm 119, 67, 68, 71, these three verses, before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I obey your word, for you're good, for you are good, and what you do is to teach us your laws. It was good for me to be afflicted, so that I might learn your way. God said, I'm there for you. I'm the rock. And if you get no other lesson out of this, get the visual reality that the walk that we're doing, that we call our Christian life, our journey through this wilderness in the world, that the promise is there. Hebrews 13:5, I will never leave you, forsake you. Matthew 28, the last two verses, lo, I am with you always, till the end of the age. Romans 8, that the Spirit will help us in our weakness. We need the quiet, lonely solitude of our own wilderness. You see, we think of our Christian life in warm, fuzzy terms. We need to think of it in wilderness terms. That this is a journey. It's not easy. It's not an easy way, the easy road, this way to glory. It's not an easy path to take. But it's the way our Savior trod. Discipleship is not a comfortable process. And so in this first half of Exodus 17, and we divided the message into two parts. This is the first part. Aren't you thankful? Exodus 17 of the miracle here. We're going to get the battle part of it. The smitten rock next week, the smitten enemies of God, as God wins a great victory at Rephidim at the same place. God's power, man's effort is just to obey. God's going to provide the rock. He's going to provide the water. He's going to provide all we need. We just have to trust and obey. For there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Some of the most unhappy people I know are Christians because they aren't willing to live by faith. They aren't willing to trust God and say, Lord, I don't see you. I don't feel you. I'm in the wilderness. Lord, I'm in Wyoming. What have I done wrong in a previous life that you'd put me here in Wyoming in this life? But God's saying, I want you to watch because I'm there. I want you to obey because I'm with you. I want you not to worry, not to fret, not to stew, not to gripe, not to grumble, not to threaten, not to test me. God says, I don't want you to doubt. I want you to believe. He uses times that we suppose he's absent to show us how real and present he is. He often reveals his presence through circumstances in which he appears to be absent. I'd encourage you, folks. It's a battle with me because you know what? I walk through the same wilderness you do. And I've been walking through it almost 70 years now. And you know what? He's never failed me yet. Don't we sing that song? He's never failed me yet. God, no. He's never failed me, period. Don't put a question mark where God put a period. Say, God, I believe it. And even if I can't see you, the rock is here. God is always present.